Come try new Skyline Dip Cholitos at your neighborhood Skyline today. A warm, soft tortilla filled with their amazing chili and cheese with an extra layer of cream cheese and crunchy Fritos corn chips. At participating Skyline restaurants for a limited time.
Hello, folks, and welcome to ACRAC. You may notice a little different intro, and that is because this is a little bit of a different episode, and clearly and by far the hardest one I've ever had to do. I wish more than anything that Jillian Isaac was here with me to do this 27th keyword episode, but there will not be any more episodes with Jillian. As many of you know, Jillian passed away tragically and suddenly a couple of weeks ago. Jillian loved doing the keyword episodes, and as hard as it is to imagine doing them without her, I know that that is exactly what she would want us to do. And so I will do my best to move forward and to do this one on shock states alone. I know I will not be able to do it as well as I could have done it with Jillian, but I know she would want me to try. But before I do, I want to say a few words about Jillian. Many of you knew her only through these episodes, and she was fantastic at them. But she was also an amazing person, teacher, friend, colleague, and, most of all, mother and wife. She loved her family so much. And if her husband and children ever listen to this, I want them to never, ever forget or doubt that they were always her number one priority. She was also always an advocate for others to find time to be with their families whenever possible. She was the true definition of a teacher and mentor. They say a teacher affects eternity. You never know where her influence stops. That was Jillian. She helped so many learners across the world, and I know countless people are grateful to her. More than anything, Jillian believed in people and wanted them to succeed. As hard as it is to see beyond the grief we all feel, I knew Jillian very well, and I know she would want us to smile, to laugh, to love, and to learn. She would want us to support each other as she supported all of us. She would want us to feel cared about and valued and worthwhile. And so, Jillian, I miss you, and this one's for you. All right, folks, we're going to try to do this. The key word here is shock states, and that is talking about shock, what it means, the four different types of shock, and how to differentiate them, and we'll go over some of the questions that often can come up about these on your exams. This is highly tested, and while you know from Jillian in the past episodes telling you that we no longer have the published information about exactly when this came up or when the most recent one was, we do know that these are frequently tested. So what is shock? Shock is defined as a state of cellular and tissue hypoxia. So the tissue is not getting, and the cells really are not getting enough oxygen, either because there's not enough being delivered or because it's not enough to match their consumption. And so they are in a state of shock. Now, shock, as I said, is classified into four different categories: distributive, hypovolemic, cardiogenic, and obstructive. You can also, of course, have mixed shock where you have more than one participating. So obviously, for example, you could have septic shock, which is a type of distributive shock, and also cardiogenic shock. So you could have a heart failure and a patient who's also septic. So we'll go through each one of these subtypes of shock and talk about how they may come up on your exams. Let's start with distributive shock. So this, of course, is characterized by vasodilation, low systemic vascular resistance. So the way to think about this is that the tank has essentially gotten too big, and so it is relatively underfilled, even though the amount of fluid hasn't changed. So imagine that you have a tank full of water, and it's full. And now you make that tank stretch out so that it's now twice the size that it was. You haven't taken any water away, but now the tank is only half full. And so that's what we're talking about here. When you vasodilate inappropriately, you now have relative hypovolemia. It's not hypovolemic shock because you haven't actually lost fluid or blood, but you are relatively volume down because you're vasodilated, and that's when the where the low systemic vascular resistance comes into play. So the most common by far is septic shock. That's the most common form of distributive shock that you're going to see. You can also get, and we see often postoperatively, inflammation that is not from sepsis. So for example, postoperatively, after big surgeries, patients often have what we call a SIRS-like response or a post-op inflammatory response where they can get vasodilation from that inflammation in the absence of infection. So it's not sepsis. Other causes certainly that cause inflammation, things like pancreatitis, that it may be sterile, you may not have an infection, but can certainly also cause distributive shock. Neurogenic shock is a type of distributive shock where you have lost the ability of the sympathetic nervous system to cause vasoconstriction, and so you are then inappropriately vasodilated. So that is another form of distributive shock. Same thing, the tank gets inappropriately big. Anaphylaxis is another very well-known form of distributive shock where you have inappropriate vasodilation in, of course, response to mast cell degranulation from an inciting event. We can also cause it ourselves. So an overdose of a vasodilator, maybe we gave too much propofol with induction, and now we have a very vasodilated patient who's hypotensive. That is a form, if it lasts long enough to cause tissue hypoxia, of distributive shock. And of course, you could accidentally put someone on too much inhaled anesthetic. Maybe you turned up the SIVO to 3 or 4 because they were hypertensive and you just wanted to get some on board, but you left it there and now they're hypotensive and in distributive shock because of the vasodilation you've caused. So the final one that you'll see is if there's an endocrine cause, so or a thyroid hormone cause, in other words, some reason that the body can't vasoconstrict, not because the nervous system is not working, but because some cofactor like cortisol coming from the adrenal glands or thyroid hormone from the thyroid gland is not present, and so you cannot appropriately tighten things up. That would also lead to potentially distributive shock. So very important in distributive shock to remember, SVR is low. That's the main hallmark of this type of shock, that's systemic vascular resistance, SVR. So you will have high cardiac output. Of course, this is assuming this is not mixed shock, so you don't have concomitant cardiogenic shock. If it's just distributive shock, you will have high cardiac output because the heart doesn't have much to push against, so it's easy to push out. So if anything, you'll be a hyperdynamic, high output heart. You will have relatively warm extremities usually because you're vasodilated. And that may even be true despite having low blood pressure because you can't vasoconstrict. You're inappropriately vasodilated. The heart, as I said, is working just fine. If you were to do an echo, if anything, you'd see a hyperdynamic left ventricle and right ventricle potentially. These patients need fluid, pressors, and if it's sepsis that is the cause, antibiotics. And as always, in any kind of shock, you want to search for the cause and then attempt to treat it. So if you determine that the cause is adrenal insufficiency, you want to give cortisol, for example. All right, let's look at some questions that will be the types of questions you could easily see on your exams. All right, obviously, I'm doing this alone. I will read myself the question and then help you explain how I would think through it. So the first question is, a patient is in the ICU a few hours post-op from a HIPEC procedure. They received rocuronium and Sugammonex in the OR, ANSEF and Flagyl for antibiotics in the OR, and 4 units of packed red blood cells and 2 units of FFP during the procedure. Their final hemoglobin was 9. They are now requiring vasopressors to keep their MAP above 65. What most likely explains the need for vasopressors in this patient? All right. So remember, they've got rocuronium, Sugammonex, ANSEF and Flagyl, antibiotics, they got some blood, they got some FFP, and now they're hypotensive, requiring vasopressors. So the choices are A, anaphylaxis, B, cardiogenic shock, C, distributive shock, D, hemorrhagic shock. All right, so let's go through those. I think in the stem, they're giving you some things to make you think maybe it could be anaphylaxis, right? So they got antibiotics. They got rocuronium. They got Sugammonex. So especially if you've seen anaphylaxis to one of these, that may make you think about anaphylaxis. We'll come back to that. Cardiogenic shock. So is it possible? Sure. There's nothing in here that would suggest that. And relatively, a patient who, in theory, if they were going in for this procedure, didn't go in with heart failure, probably relatively unlikely, not impossible, but relatively unlikely. Distributive shock. So certainly the most common reason for hypotension after surgery, especially a big inflammatory surgery like a HIPEC, that's hyperthermic intraperitoneal chemotherapy. So big all-day procedure with really inflammatory chemotherapy pumped into the peritoneum. They are going to be really inflammatory, okay? So you've got to be thinking they could be really vasodilated from that, and indeed that is very common, and that is going to be the right answer here. Hemorrhagic shock, not, again, that that's impossible, but they're telling you they got some blood, their final hemoglobin was 9, probably less likely. And then going back to anaphylaxis, you don't want to – remember, anaphylaxis, it sticks in our minds because it's so dramatic, but it is relatively uncommon. So by far the most likely thing here is distributive shock, answer choice C. All right. Next question. What is the best way to distinguish neurogenic shock due to high spinal cord injury from hypovolemic shock? All right. Choice A. In neurogenic shock, BP, blood pressure, is high, and in hypovolemic shock, it is low. B. In neurogenic shock, heart rate is low, and in hypovolemic shock, it is high. C. Hypovolemic shock will respond to norepinephrine, but neurogenic shock will not. D. They can only be distinguished by placing a PA catheter. All right. So let's go through those. A, in neurogenic shock, the blood pressure is high. In hypovolemic shock, it is low. No. So obviously shock is shock. You're going to have low blood pressure. So in neurogenic shock, the blood pressure is low. And at hypovolemic shock, it is low. So that's wrong. All right. B, in neurogenic shock, the heart rate is low often. And in hypovolemic shock, it is high. So that is true. In neurogenic shock, because you have lost the – so think about it like they said here, a high spinal cord injury. You don't have the input back through the spinal cord to the heart causing the accelerate. You don't have – you've lost the cardiac accelerator fibers input, so you can't get the tachycardic response to hypotension. So it's not – depending on where your spinal cord injury is and what's causing it – this isn't necessarily 100% of the time, but think about neurogenic shock as often having an inappropriately low heart rate. So that is true, whereas hypovolemic shock, your heart rate should be high. There's, of course, always possibilities, patients on a lot of beta block or whatever, where you may not have that, but this generally should be true. So that's going to be your answer. Answer choice B. C was hypovolemic shock will respond to norepi, but neurogenic shock will not. No, they both should respond to norepi. D, they can only be distinguished by placing a PA catheter. No, you should be able to distinguish them in other ways. All right, next question. A patient with severe asthma is in the ICU after abdominal surgery, and despite adequate fluid resuscitation, they are requiring max doses of 2 pressors, norepinephrine and vasopressin, to maintain their mean arterial pressure. Peak airway pressures are 15. Oxygen saturation is 100% on 30% FiO2. Lactate is 0.4. What treatment will most likely improve the patient's blood pressure? A, add vasopressin. B, give albuterol. C, disconnect the ventilator and allow the patient to exhale. D, give 50 milligrams of hydrocortisone. And sorry, answer choice A should have been add epinephrine, not add vasopressin. So A, add epinephrine. B, give albuterol. C, disconnect the ventilator and allow the patient to exhale. D, give 50 milligrams of hydrocortisone. All right, so adding epinephrine. So they're maxed out on norepi and vasopressin. The question is there a reason to think this could be cardiogenic shock that we would need to add some additional pressor like epinephrine? There's nothing in here that tells us or points us toward cardiogenic shock. And so that seems relatively unlikely and what doesn't really get at what the underlying cause is if not. I mean, it may help to add a third pressor in terms of the blood pressure coming up, but doesn't really get at the cause. B, give albuterol. So they told you this patient has severe asthma. And so you may think, could it be that they just are having a really, really intense asthma? We may think of the fact that if they are having bad, bad bronchoconstriction and bronchospasm, they may not be able to exhale. That's what choice C is getting at. So that, are they developing all this auto PEEP and then they can't exhale? Well, they're satting great, right? 100% on 30% FiO2. Seems unlikely they're having a horrible asthma attack. Their peak pressures are only 15, so that's really not consistent with auto PEEP and that buildup of intrathoracic pressure. So probably not either of those. And then we remember this patient has severe asthma. It's very likely that they may be on or have been recently on steroids for their asthma. They may therefore not be able to mount an adequate adrenal response and so be relatively adrenal insufficient. these people who are really inappropriately on high dose pressors where nothing else seems to make sense, they may need to have stress dose steroids. And so giving 50 milligrams of hydrocortisone is probably most likely of these choices to make the difference. All right, let's move on to our next question. And that is the following. And this is getting now more at some of the other aspects that go along with questions about sepsis and septic shock. So which of the following correctly lists the three components of the quick sequential sepsis-related organ failure assessment, also known as QSOFA? Which of the following represents correctly lists the three components of this score that's used to identify early sepsis? A, altered mentation, a respiratory rate greater than 22, and a systolic blood pressure less than 100. B, serum creatinine greater than 1.1, respiratory rate greater than 20, heart rate greater than 100. C, a temperature greater than 38.3, respiratory rate greater than 22, systolic blood pressure less than 100. D, white blood cell count greater than 12,000, respiratory rate greater than 20, heart rate greater than 100. All right. So the answer here is A. It's just you know it or you don't, right? These are the three components of QSOFA: altered mental status, a respiratory rate greater than 22, and a systolic pressure less than 100. And so this is something you could easily get asked about when you're thinking about sepsis. You should think about how to screen for it and how to treat it in addition to what septic shock is. So that's why I included that here. All right. Next question. Which of the following is a recommendation for the management of a patient with sepsis or septic shock according to the Surviving Sepsis campaign? So now we're getting at management of septic shock. A, administration of broad-spectrum antibiotic therapy between 2 to 3 hours of diagnosis. B, in patients requiring vasopressors, use an initial mean arterial pressure target of 65 millimeters of mercury. C, initial resuscitation of sepsis-induced hypoperfusion with greater than 60 mLs per kilo of crystalloid within the first 3 hours. And those are the answer choices. The answer here is B, and hopefully everyone knows that we always shoot for a MAP of 65 initially. The others are not right because antibiotics should be given within 1 hour, not 2 to 3, and because initial resuscitation should be 30 mLs per kilo, not 60. Okay, so that's why that one is wrong. Always think about fast antibiotics and getting that MAP up to goal of 65. All right. Last in this section, which of the following is recommended in the management of a patient with septic shock? A, avoidance of corticosteroid use in resistant hypotension. B, norepinephrine as a first-line vasopressor. C, use of low-dose dopamine to support renal function. All right. Hopefully you know here the answer is B. So norepinephrine is our first-line vasopressor in septic shock. We definitely don't need to avoid corticosteroids. In fact, if we think that adrenal insufficiency may be a part of the picture, we may give stress dose steroids. And then the thought that low-dose dopamine is effective to support renal function is no longer – when I was training, that was actually quite commonly thought and done, but no longer the case. So we use norepinephrine. There's a lot of debate about when you should or shouldn't add vasopressin. The data is very mixed. Some practitioners, when the norepi gets up to a certain level, will add vasopressin. It used to be 0.04, now usually 0.03. Some don't do that until they've completely maxed out the norepinephrine. I don't think you're going to get asked about that because there is no set right answer for that. Okay, let's move to cardiogenic shock. So in cardiogenic shock, you now have low cardiac output. Remember in septic shock and in distributive shock, we had high cardiac output. In cardiogenic shock, it's going to be low. And that is because the heart, the pump itself is not working, right? So the tank is fine. There's plenty of fluid in the tank. Maybe there's even too much, but certainly not low. And the SVR is not inappropriately high, but the heart is not able to push out for some reason. The most common being heart failure. The heart muscle is not working. You can also have arrhythmias that lead to inappropriately low cardiac output. And you can have valve problems, right? So a valve stenosis, for example, or a wide open valve insufficiency may cause you to have inappropriately low cardiac output. So again, the pump is not working. Cardiac output is low. The peripheral nervous system is fine. So you will have intense vasoconstriction because the blood pressure will be low because of the low cardiac output, and the body will appropriately squeeze down the extremities. So the extremities will be relatively cold. If you were to have a PA catheter, a Swan-Ganz catheter, and you were to measure a wedge pressure. And, you know, we don't do this a lot, right? We don't use Swans a lot, but they still come up on tests. So you should know at least the basics so that a wedge pressure is where you advance the Swan-Ganz catheter into the pulmonary artery and you are doing a wedge so that you are going far enough so that you're actually past the main pulmonary artery into the distal ones, where you are going to be able to approximate, in theory, the pressure in the left ventricle. So that is what your wedge pressure is trying to do, is to give you an idea of the pressure in the left ventricle at during diastole, right? So when the mitral valve is open, then the left atrium communicates with the left ventricle, and those pressures should be equalized. And so your pressure that you're measuring, if you think just straight line through the pulmonary vein into the left atrium, if the mitral valve is open, then also gives you a feel for what's happening in the left ventricle. So the idea is to get the pressure in the left ventricle during diastole. If the heart is failing, then that pressure is going to be high because the heart is not able to push the blood out. The pressure is going to build up and back up. And so you're going to have a high wedge pressure in heart failure. And in, for example, distributive shock, if you were to do the same thing, you'd have a low wedge pressure because the heart is totally fine. It's able to push forward and you don't have buildup of pressure backwards. All right. So which of the following, first question, which of the following results in decrease mixed venous oxygen saturation? All right, so if you don't know, you should know this because it's going to come up on tests. Mixed venous oxygen saturation, you can only get mixed venous if you have a Swan, a PA catheter. If you have a central line, you can get a central venous. Those are pretty similar, not exactly, but if you have a mixed venous, it is coming from a PA catheter, okay? And either one, a mixed venous or a central venous, this would apply to. So which results in a decreased mixed oxygen saturation, mixed venous oxygen saturation? A, cardiogenic shock. B, decreased metabolic rate. C, increased cardiac output. D, left to right intracardiac shunt. E, pulmonary vasodilation. All right. So cardiogenic shock should be the answer here. It results in decreased mixed venous oxygen saturation. And that is because you can't push, your cardiac output is low. So you're delivering per unit time less blood and therefore less oxygen to tissue. So the tissue is going to have to take up more of it from each unit of blood, from each, you know, piece of blood that goes through, each milliliter of blood that goes through. And so you're going to have less left over. So when the blood gets back before it gets to the lung, as it passes into the pulmonary artery, it will have its lowest, it will be lower. The venous saturation will be lower than it would have been if you weren't in cardiogenic shock. So a normal mixed venous oxygen saturation might be 70%. In bad cardiogenic shock, it may be very low, 40% less. It can be very, very low, and that's a bad sign. All right. So B was decreased metabolic rate. So no, if you have a decreased metabolic rate, you're using less oxygen, so you're mixed venous oxygen saturation will be higher. C, increased cardiac output. So this would be the opposite. In increased cardiac output, you are delivering more oxygen. Therefore, the tissues need to take less of it out. So your resulting mixed venous oxygen saturation will be higher. Left to right intracardiac shunt. So here your left very oxygenated blood is shunting over to the right. When you measure it, you're going to have a higher percentage of oxygen. And then pulmonary vasodilation. So here you are now going to have more blood in contact with the alveoli, getting more oxygen in, and so your saturation should be higher. All right. Stay with us. We'll be right back. All right, and we're back. And here's the next question. What is the best way to differentiate septic shock from cardiogenic shock? A, in septic shock, extremities will be cool, while in cardiogenic shock, they will be warm. B, in septic shock, lactate will be high, but in cardiogenic shock, it will be low. C, in septic shock, wedge pressure will be low, and in cardiogenic shock, it will be high. D, glucagon is the agent of choice in septic shock, but not in cardiogenic shock. All right. So A, in septic shock, extremities will be cool, while in cardiogenic shock, they will be warm. No, it's the opposite. In B, in septic shock, lactate will be high, but in cardiogenic shock, it will be low. No, lactate should be high in both. In septic shock, wedge pressure will be low, and in cardiogenic shock, it will be high. That is true. We just talked about that. And then D, glucagon is the agent of choice in septic shock, but not in cardiogenic shock. No, glucagon is the agent of choice. Norepinephrine is the agent of choice in septic shock. Glucagon is very specifically a potential reversal agent for beta blocker overdose. All right. Next, which of the following is not typical of cardiogenic shock? A, low mixed venous oxygen saturation. B, high SVR. C, low cardiac output. D, low wedge pressure. All right, so we just talked about this, so you should know it's D, low wedge pressure. is typical of cardiogenic shock. Therefore, this question is asking what's not typical, and D would be the answer. Let's go through the other ones. A, low mixed venous oxygen sat. That is typical. We just talked about that. B, high SVR. We talked about that before. You're going to be clamped down. You will have high SVR. And then C, low cardiac output is, again, typical because your heart is not working. All right. Next, which of the following is not a good treatment for a patient with cardiogenic shock and pulmonary edema? A, epinephrine. B, mannitol. C, norepinephrine. D, positive pressure ventilation. All right. So A, epinephrine. Cardiogenic shock, certainly something that will help push forward, is probably a good idea, and epinephrine will do that. It's a little tricky here. If you're hypertensive, then it may actually not be a good option because then you're going to make it harder for the heart to push. And raise SVR, and that may make things worse. But certainly we think of at least low-dose epinephrine as maybe being a good thing in cardiogenic shock. B, mannitol. That's going to be the answer here because mannitol will at least transiently increase the circulating volume, and in pulmonary edema and in heart failure, a big increase in circulating volume can make heart failure worse. C, norepinephrine. Certainly, again, some low-dose norepinephrine is probably reasonable. Sometimes people think that norepi is not great in cardiogenic shock, and certainly high dose, probably not, because you may be, again, raising SVR too much, but low dose is probably fine. And then D, positive pressure ventilation. So for left heart failure, and the next question gets at this, positive pressure ventilation is actually helpful. All right, next question is, which of the following is true of positive pressure ventilation? A, it helps both right and left heart failure. B, it helps right-sided heart failure but hurts left-sided heart failure. C, it hurts both left and right-sided heart failure. D, it helps left-sided but hurts right-sided. So the answer here is D. Positive pressure ventilation will help right-sided heart failure, but it will make will help left-sided heart failure, but it will make right-sided heart failure worse. And so the way to think about this is that positive pressure ventilation will actually help the LV to push. But for right-sided heart failure, it will decrease venous return to the right heart, and it will also increase PVR. So it is causing increased pressure in the thorax that the right heart has to push against, and so it will make right heart failure worse. So for both of those reasons, the answer here is D. It helps left-sided heart failure, but hurts right-sided heart failure. All right. A patient on high-dose beta blockade is scheduled for a Whipple. Following surgery, the patient's cardiac output, as measured by bedside TTE, is very low, despite norepinephrine infusion. Which of the following best explains why a glucagon infusion may be helpful? A, it improves myocardial contractility by increasing intracellular cyclic AMP. B, it acts on the adrenergic receptor to synergize with norepinephrine. C, it binds to and inactivates beta blockers. So, you know, this could easily come up. As I said before, we think of glucagon as a potential treatment for beta blocker overdose. But if someone's on high-dose beta blockade and they have a really low cardiac output, you could use glucagon. And it's important, not in real life, but for your test to know why it works. And that is by improving cardiac myocardial contractility by increasing intracellular CAMP. Okay, it does not work on catechol receptors. It is not... it's a non-catechol action, and it does not work synergistically to help norepi work better. It's its own action that's non-catechol, and then it does not bind to it and activate the beta blockers. That's not how it works. It just gets around the beta blockade because beta blockers are blocking catechols, and glucagon acts on a non-catechol receptor. All right, let's move on to hypovolemic shock. Here we're talking about lack of fluid in the tank. So are in isolated hypovolemic shock, the heart is working fine, the systemic vascular resistance is working fine, but the amount of fluid in the tank is low. And that can come from one of two possible ways, either from hemorrhage, so that would be hemorrhagic shock, losing blood, or non-hemorrhagic shock, so losing fluid some other way. So, for example, losing fluid through the GI tract with extreme diarrhea or vomiting. Third spacing fluid can also do it. Insensible losses, extreme insensible losses can also do it. So remember, again, as I said, there's nothing wrong with the peripheral nervous system. So systemic vascular resistance will be elevated. The extremities will be cool because you're clamped down. If you were to do a pulmonary capillary wedge pressure like we talked about before, that should be low because cardiac output will be low because there's not a lot of fluid to push, but the heart function will be fine. Okay, so don't confuse pulmonary capillary wedge pressure with cardiac output. We're talking, as I said before, the wedge pressure gives you when it works, right? An approximation of left ventricular function. And in this case, left ventricular function is fine. The left ventricle can work fine. There's no backup of fluid, but cardiac output is low because there's not a lot to push out because the total volume is low. Okay. So if you did an echo, you can differentiate between cardiogenic and hypovolemic shock by whether the heart is overfilled or underfilled, right? So in cardiogenic shock, the heart is full. It can't push it out. In hypovolemic shock, the heart is empty because there's not anything to fill it with. All right, let's look at some questions. Which of the following well-validated techniques or measures can be used in a spontaneously breathing patient to assess fluid responsiveness? A, capillary refill time. B, central venous pressure. C, passive leg raise. D, pulse pressure variation. Okay, so here we're getting at trying to figure out if a patient is fluid down and would benefit from fluid. And the answer here in a spontaneously breathing patient, that's key, is passive leg raise. So capillary refill time is A, and that is not necessarily a good way to tell you whether the patient is fluid responsive. That's going to tell you something about whether they're clamped down, but not whether they're fluid responsive. Central venous pressure, definitely not. I think everybody knows that that is not a good way to tell if a patient is fluid responsive. And then pulse pressure variation in a ventilated patient who is paralyzed and not breathing spontaneously, pulse pressure variation can be helpful. But in a spontaneously breathing patient, much less so. All right. Which of the following distinguishes hypovolemic shock from septic shock? A, the wedge pressure is high in septic shock, but low in hypovolemic shock. B, the SVR is high in hypovolemic shock, but low in septic shock. C, stress dose steroids are often required in hypovolemic shock, but not in septic shock. D, epinephrine is the pressor of choice in hypovolemic and norepinephrine in septic shock. All right, let's go through those. The answer is B, SVR is high in hypovolemic shock, but low in septic shock. So remember, in hypovolemic shock, you're going to be clamped down. In septic shock, you're going to be vasodilated. So that's the answer. Let's look at the others. A, wedge pressure is high in septic shock, but low in hypovolemic shock. No, wedge pressure should be low in both of those, right? Because the heart is working fine. C, stress dose steroids are often required in hypovolemic shock. No, no reason in hypovolemic shock, sometimes in septic shock. And D, epinephrine is the pressor of choice in hypovolemic and norepi in septic. So norepi is the pressor of choice in septic shock. In hypovolemic shock, you really want to give fluid and or blood. If you need a pressor to tide you over, then there's no reason it would need to be epinephrine. So norepinephrine would be probably your go-to pressor there as well. All right. And finally, obstructive shock. So here, cardiac output is reduced, but not because the heart is failing. There's something that is preventing the heart from working. So the classic is cardiac tamponade. The heart can't fill because, and therefore can't eject much because it is being squeezed by the cardiac tamponade. Tension pneumothorax can also do it. Severe pulmonary hypertension can prevent blood from getting from the right to the left heart. Pulmonary embolus, same thing. A massive pulmonary embolus can prevent blood from getting from the right to the left heart. And then the other one that's a little tricky is just a lack of venous return. If you have enough blockage of venous return and nothing's getting back to the heart, then the heart has nothing to pump out. And so there's obstruction of blood flow. So it's very similar to cardiogenic shock in terms of the exam, but here the heart will be underfilled, not overfilled, because it can't fill, right? There's something stopping it from adequately filling. Unlike hypovolemic shock, usually in obstructive shock, the CVP will be high unless the problem is lack of venous return. So that's the one-off that may not be true. But usually the CVP will be high because there's a backup because the blood can't get out of the heart or maybe into it. So it's backing up into the venous system. In hypovolemic shock, of course, the CVP should be low. Again, assuming there's no cardiogenic problem along with it. Your wedge pressure may or may not be high. If the cause of the obstruction is constricting the heart, like tamponade, then your wedge will be high because, again, you're going to have a inability. You're going to have a backup of pressure that's from that squeezing of the LV. If it's a massive pulmonary embolus causing blockage of blood from right to left, then you're not going to have blood on the left. It's going to be an underfilling problem and your wedge should be low. So that's I don't think you're going to get asked about that in obstructive shock because it depends unless they give you the cause. So if they told you it was tamponade, then your wedge is going to be high. If they told you it was a massive PE, then it's going to be low. All right. Here's a couple example questions on this. Okay. So 3 hours after undergoing coronary artery bypass grafting, an elderly man developed severe hypotension after intravenous administration of morphine 4 milligrams. Pulmonary artery occlusion pressure is 27 and central venous pressure is 30. Transesophageal echo shows decreased end-diastolic ventricular volumes. Which of the following is the most likely diagnosis? A, anaphylactoid reaction. B, cardiac tamponade. C, coronary graft occlusion. D, excessive fluid administration. E, pulmonary thromboembolus. Okay, so key things here. One, they're trying to get you to think about, they just got this morphine and now they're having this severe hypotension. Could it be an anaphylactoid reaction? So possible, but this is pretty extreme, and there's some other things pointing you to another possible reaction. And if it was anaphylaxis, meaning you were really vasodilated and your heart is fine, then you should have a low wedge pressure, not a high wedge pressure. So that's why that doesn't fit. What they're showing you here is not only a high wedge pressure, which points to the heart not working well, but also pulmonary artery occlusion pressure, which is the wedge pressure is high, but also the central venous pressure is high, and you have transesophageal echo showing end diastolic, decreased end diastolic ventricular volume, so almost ventricular collapse in end diastole. So there's something preventing filling. So that's really the key here, where you get these equalization of pressures between the CVP and the left heart, and then they're giving you this end diastolic ventricular almost collapse or even collapse. That is pretty consistent with tamponade. So the answer here is tamponade. Coronary graft occlusion. So they're pointing you there by saying you may think, well, maybe that happened. The coronary graft went down. The heart is failing, and that would cause the wedge to be elevated and the CVP to be elevated if the heart was failing. But it should not cause decreased end diastolic ventricular volume. So that is point you away and more toward tamponade. Excessive fluid administration. Again, you shouldn't have decreased end diastolic volume. And then pulmonary thromboembolus, you would have a low, if it was big enough, you'd have a low wedge, right? Because you're not able to fill the left heart, so your wedge would be low, not high. Okay, a patient with a large abdominal tumor presents for resection. He receives an intravenous induction with standard dosing and is placed on SIVO for maintenance. The case proceeds uneventfully with minimal blood loss. After surgical incision and during dissection around the tumor, he develops hypotension that is refractory to fluid boluses and epinephrine boluses. What is the most likely type of shock causing the hypotension? A, cardiogenic. B, distributive. C, hypovolemic. D, obstructive. All right, so here you know a few things. So they're dissecting around this big tumor in the abdomen. And after they've done some dissection, he gets really hypotensive. And fluid isn't helping. Epinephrine is not helping. So it could be cardiogenic, but you don't have anything pointing you there. And if it was cardiogenic, maybe epinephrine would help. Distributive, again, there is no reason to think that this patient is vasodilated. And if he was, the epinephrine should help. Hypovolemic, again, it says he's not responsive to fluid boluses, so probably less likely. And then obstructive. So you got this big tumor, could easily be collapsing the IVC and the venous return. And so that's what they're trying to get at here, is thinking about this less common type of obstructive shock where something is actually decreasing venous return. So that's the answer. All right. Next, a patient with severe asthma is in the ICU postoperatively. pH was 7.15, so vent settings were increased to a tidal volume of 400 and a respiratory rate of 22. The pH improved, but the blood pressure is now 70 over 40 with increasing doses of norepi. What is most likely to help? A, disconnect the vent. B, give a blood transfusion. C, give amiodarone. D, add vasopressin. So what they're trying to get at here, we had a prior question about a patient with severe asthma, and I said that it probably wasn't auto-PEEP because of the peak pressure being low. Here, they're not giving you the peak pressure, but you do have the fact that a patient with severe asthma had their respiratory rate increased. It's another hypotensive. It is most likely auto-PEEP causing decreased venous return. So you want to disconnect the vent. Giving a blood transfusion, there's no reason to think that the patient needs a blood transfusion. Not that that couldn't be possible, but we don't have anything pointing us that way. Giving amiodarone. So again, nothing pointing here towards an arrhythmia that would require that. And then adding an additional pressor, while that might help, isn't getting at the cause. So we really want to think what could be the cause here. And they're pointing us toward that auto-PEEP buildup of pressure in the thorax from inadequate exhalation time in a patient with severe asthma. All right. Next, a patient with a history of COPD comes in for resection of a pheochromocytoma. You place a central line in the right IJ after induction and start the case. During dissection, the blood pressure steadily falls and is refractory to fluid and minimally responsive to pressors. Peak airway pressure is 40. The SAT is 85% on 100% FiO2. Which of the following is the most likely cause? A, right main stem intubation. B, bronchospasm. C, cardiac tamponade. D, tension pneumothorax. E, decreased release of catechols from the tumor. All right. So here, this could easily come up on oral boards where they give you something like this. And what you want to think about is a patient with COPD is likely to have increased lung volumes, maybe blebs. You're putting in a central line. There's a chance of a pneumothorax. And if you now have kind of steadily falling over time blood pressure with high peak pressures, low SATs, despite high FiO2, this is really pointing you toward a pneumothorax. Now, of course, it'd be nice if they told you you had decreased breath sounds, but they're not telling you that. On oral boards, you could ask that or say, I would listen for breath sounds. But here, they're not giving you that, so you have to pick. Could it be a right main stem intubation? That would certainly give you high peak airway pressures and maybe decrease SATs, but probably not hypotension. The bronchospasm, again, they're telling you that the SATs are down. Bronchospasm could cause that. It could cause high peak airway pressures, but again, shouldn't cause hypotension. Cardiac tamponade certainly could cause hypotension, but no reason to think about that here unless you really screwed up with your central line placement and pierced the pericardium. But also, the cardiac tamponade would not cause peak airway pressures to be high. Bronchospasm. We already did that one. Tension pneumothorax is the most likely thing here, as I said, and then decreased release of catechols from the tumor. So while eventually when they clamp the venous outflow from the tumor, you can get decreased catechols. That can cause hypotension, but it would not cause the airway issues here. All right. So these are all highly tested. I think you will definitely see these types of shock on your exams. You need to know how to think about them. You need to know what is characteristic of each one. You need to know how to differentiate one from the other. This is high yield both for your written exams and your oral exams. They can ask you, they can give you a scenario and ask you, what do you think is going on? What kind of shock could this be? How do you know it's not this other kind of shock? And how to treat them? So all really, really high yield stuff. All right, let's turn to the portion of the show where we make random recommendations. My random recommendation is a little atypical. I'm going to recommend that in honor of Jillian's memory, we all try to find at least one person we can say thank you to. One person to whom we can express our gratitude for what they've done for us. Because it's easy to think that there's plenty of time, but sometimes there isn't. And we would all be better off if we took a few minutes to express our gratitude to those who have made a difference in our lives. It can make more of a difference than we could ever really know. I am grateful to all of you for listening to ACRAC and for working so hard to do the incredibly important work that you do every day. I hope you know that when I say at the end of every episode that what you're doing out there every day is really important and valued, it's not just a tagline. I mean it, and I want you to know it and believe it, because I know some days it doesn't feel like it's true. But I know that you're doing important work and that you're valued. And Jillian knew that too. And I hope that Jillian knew how valued she was by all of us. But I think there's nothing more significant we could do for her memory than to make sure that the people who do matter to us know that they do and know how much they mean to us and know how grateful we are to them. Thank you so much for listening and for sharing my gratitude to Jillian for all that she did for so many people during the course of her life. I'm going to end this one simply by saying thank you to all of you. Thank you to my incredible ACRAC team. And again, truly, truly, what you are doing out there every day is really important and is so, so valued.
We interrupt this program to bring you an important Wayfair message. Wayfair's got style tips for every home. This is Styles McKenzie helping you make those rooms sing. Today's style tip: when it comes to making a statement, treat bold patterns like neutrals. Go wild, like an untamed animal print area rug under a rustic farmhouse table from Wayfair.com. Arr, fierce. This has been your Wayfair style tip to keep those interiors superior.
Wayfair, every style, every home.
American Giant makes great clothing, sweatshirts, jeans, and more right here in the U.S. Visit American-Giant.com and get 20% off your first order with code STAPLE20. That's 20% off your first order at American-Giant.com, code STAPLE20.